core values of this nation, our standing in the world, our very democracy, everything that has made America, America is at stake. That's why today I'm announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Former Vice President Joe Biden there making it official this morning with an ad focused on the 2017 white supremacist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the president's response to that. Biden is running, and let's get reaction from the Democratic strategist, Bill Press. Hi, Bill.
Jeremy, how are you? Good to talk to you.
Doing well. And Biden is doing well already before he got in. He's sort of at the top of the national polls on the Democratic side. He's got a lot of name recognition. How do you think his entrance, though, changes this race?
Well, I think he comes in as the clear front runner in this race. Even before he entered, he was. He is a strong force, I believe, that everybody else is going to have to contend with. I find it very interesting, as I talk to Democrats around the country, because with all the excitement about the new faces and the young faces and women running and people of color running, there's still sort of a yearning for somebody solid and steady and almost old-fashioned, right? And that is Joe Biden.
Well, what do you think about the fact that instead of talking about his upbringing, his connection to Pennsylvania, his time as vice president, that he used this announcement video to talk about what happened in Charlottesville and President Trump's response to it?
Actually, I was a little surprised. The more I thought about it, the more I thought it was strategically very important for Biden, because he focused, yes, on Charlottesville, yes, on Donald Trump, but he used that as a bridge to really talk about American values, American character. And that does tie back to his roots in Scranton. But I think you're going to hear that from Joe Biden, that Donald Trump, rather than policy by policy by policy differing with him, is just out of step with who we as Americans really are. And that's why we have to have a change. And he's the one who can deliver that change. We're going to hear lots of his about his humble roots in Scranton. Mm-hmm. Starting Monday in Pittsburgh.
Do you think that his age is a weakness for him? He's 76. He's not the oldest candidate in the race. That would be Bernie Sanders, who is 77. But is his age something he's going to have to contend with?
Well, you know, he's younger than Ringo Starr.
Ringo's not running, though.
No, but he's older than Mick Jagger. So, you know, go figure. I think the age issue was kind of dashed once and for all by Bernie Sanders in 2016, who was the oldest person in the race, the oldest person ever to run among the among Democrats, and got more of the millennial votes than anybody else.
And by the way, by Donald Trump, who's in his 70s as well, and oldest president
exactly.
We've ever had.
So I don't think I think age is not an issue anymore.
What about some of the other things that people see as Biden's weaknesses? He's got to answer for a record in the Senate that goes back decades and includes many positions that are at odds with the Democratic base. Right now, he voted for the Iraq War. He was instrumental in the Anita Hill hearing. He supported the 1994 crime bill. Is it going to be possible for him to get past all of that?
I believe so. You and I could go down the litany of those things. Every candidate so far has something they have to almost apologize for, right? Whether it's Kamala Harris with being such a tough prosecutor, Kirsten Gillibrand for Al Franken, you know, you can go down the list. The thing that I hear most from Democrats, Jeremy, is they're looking for the person who can beat Donald Trump. And I think that's Joe Biden's strength. Look, it's not going to be automatic for him. But I think people do see him as someone who is tested, who is solid, who is steady, who can take on Donald Trump. And if that's the case, all these other issues will fade in light of that one.
How do you think that Biden is going to do among African-Americans in the Democratic Party, which are such an important part of the base?
He's got some, you know, Delaware has a large African-American population. Joe Biden is very well beloved there. He's got real deep roots in South Carolina. I think he's worked the field, and that will reap to his benefit this time.
Now, another thing that we should remember about Joe Biden is that this is not the first time he's run for president. He ran in 1988. Yes. He, by the way, when Democratic candidate Pete Buttigieg was in kindergarten, he also dropped out of the 2008 race after coming in fifth place in Iowa. Can this time be different than those other two times that he tried and failed?
That is the big question. I think the one weakness about Joe Biden is not these policy positions we talked about. It's that he has never proven to be that strong a national candidate. This is the third time. The first two times were embarrassing, actually. Remember, he almost moved to Iowa, right? I think he got his citizenship in Iowa the last time and came in fifth. Yes, he won as vice president twice because Barack Obama won, right? It was Barack Obama that pulled him through. So we've yet to see Joe Biden show strength as a national candidate. That's going to be the real test. And I think we'll see that pretty soon in the first debate and in his first forays out on the stump as his own man running for president.
One more thing, Bill. Do you think that the Democrats, now that there are so many in the race, and who knows, maybe more people will get in, that they're going to tear each other
apart?
God, let's
hope not.
Well, do you think that they're going to tear each other apart in this primary contest, go after each other for things that they did in the past and make a big deal out of certain things that happened in the past to the point that they'll weaken each other, whoever ends up facing President Trump?
Well, I know that President Trump tweeted this morning kind of warning Joe Biden that it's going to get nasty. Mm-hmm. The candidates that I've talked to and the candidates that I've seen and heard, I think they're going to do everything they can to avoid that. Because, again, the primary mission of everybody is to defeat Donald Trump. Clearly, they're going to have to, and they're going to want to, and they're going to have to distinguish themselves from others. But I think it'll be at the policy level, not at the personal attack level. And I think it could hurt anybody who tries to get nasty.
That is Democratic strategist Bill Press. Bill, thanks as always. Great to talk to you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, Spain is headed for parliamentary elections on Sunday, the country's third election in just 4 years. And for the first time since Spain's return to democracy in the late 1970s, a far-right party has a good chance of winning some parliamentary seats, possibly leading to a coalition government with two other conservative parties. Lucia Benavides reports from Spain.
Maria Bayo is drinking beer outside a neighborhood bar in the outskirts of Barcelona, talking politics with a group of friends. The 40-year-old, whose family has owned the bar for 60 years, says for her, the most important issues are the independence movement in her Catalan region and a lack of public housing. But she also worries about the emergence of a far-right party called Vox.
Están incrementando el odio, bueno, el racismo, están incrementando muchísimas cosas que estaban escondidas.
They're increasing hate, racism, and a lot of things that had been hidden, she tells me. The general elections weren't supposed to take place until next year. But Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez called for early elections after his socialist government failed to pass a budget in February. Vox is making this election different. They want to deport undocumented migrants, repeal a gender violence law that protects survivors from their abusers, and ban pro-independence organizations like in Catalonia.
Porque vosotros no tenéis que pagar ni tienen por qué ser legales los partidos que quieren destruir la convivencia, la herencia de vuestros padres, las libertades y lo mejor que los españoles tenemos.
In a recent campaign event posted online, Vox leader Santiago Abascal said Spaniards shouldn't put up with separatist parties that want to destroy Spain's heritage and freedom. Many political analysts say the right is gaining momentum because of the unresolved Catalan independence crisis. The ruling Socialist Party has been criticized for not being tough enough on Catalonia. But right-wing parties want to suspend the region's autonomy and impose direct rule from Madrid. They're also appealing to voters who oppose a growing feminist movement in Spain.
Soy mujer y no quiero que se criminalice a mi pareja por ser hombre.
A Vox campaign ad shows women asking feminists not to speak in their name. One of them says she doesn't want her partner to be criminalized for being a man. Political researcher Berta Barbet at the Autonomous University of Barcelona says the emergence of Vox and the center-right Citizens Party has caused a rift in conservative parties. They're competing for votes.
The emergence of new parties that is generating new choices that voters need to kind of clear their mind about.
Recent polls show no political party is set to win majority on Sunday, and around 30% of voters are still undecided. Barbet says it's too early to tell whether the country is headed towards a left-wing coalition or a right-wing coalition. Back at the café, María Bayó says she hopes young people especially get out and vote.
No podemos volver atrás. Estos son políticos que quieren volver atrás y no podemos permitir lo que han pasado nuestros abuelos. No lo podemos permitir.
We can't go back, and these politicians want to go back, she says of Vox. Bayó adds that it's up to the youth to prevent Spain from going through what their grandparents did more than 40 years ago under the fascist dictatorship of Francisco Franco. For NPR News, I'm Lucia Benavides in Barcelona.
Suddenly, the late Rudolf Nureyev is everywhere again. The Russian ballet dancer who rocketed to superstardom after he defected in 1961 is the subject of White Crow, a feature film directed by actor Ralph Fiennes that opens Friday in Los Angeles.
Rudy, you dream of a world that isn't this one.
He has to go to Soviet Union.
They're trying to kidnap me.
Rudy, you have to say what you want.
Okay.
I want to be free.
Oh boy. Nureyev is also the subject of a new feature-length documentary titled Nureyev, now playing in theaters. In it, there's some newly discovered performance footage of Nureyev, and co-directors Jackie and David Morris, a brother and sister team, put the dancer in historical context, focusing on how Nureyev was a pawn in the Cold War chess match between the Soviet Union and the U.S., a prism through which the West saw Russia and Russians saw the West, a thrilling celebrity we all watched. Here's the great violinist Yehudi Menuhin in the documentary.
He was a phenomenon, and he knew it, of course, and sometimes he knew it too well, but thus he was a phenomenon, and sadly destined, I imagine, to consume himself and to live to the hilt.
Let's bring in the Morrises, who co-directed Nureyev. They join us from the BBC in London. Jackie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
And
hello.
Hi. And your brother David there as well. Hi, David.
I'm there as well.
Yes. Why make this movie now? Nureyev died in 1993. He'd contracted AIDS. It was just a very poignant ending to your film. It's also a reminder that AIDS is still with us. But why make the film now?
Well, it seemed a timely thing, really, a timely subject, you know. Russia is in the news. People have also sort of forgotten about the devastation AIDS caused. And he's also one of those enormous stars that you probably won't get again. He and people like him, like Elvis, they were sort of larger than life, and they stood out more. And I think it was just we wanted to rediscover him or to show him to a generation that don't know anything about him, because dance is ephemeral, and he was such a big star. After he died, that began to fade in the public consciousness. We wanted to bring him back.
Well, and I'm so glad you did, because there are people, you know, younger people who, in watching this, were saying, wow, I didn't remember that. I didn't know that about what it was like when Nureyev defected from Russia and came to the United States in the middle, you know, in the early 60s, in the middle of this Cold War. But before we get to that, Jackie, you start the film with a reminder of Stalin's brutal purges in the late 1930s, the Gulag labor camps. Millions died from what was then the Soviet Union. And Rudolf Nureyev was born into this. Why was it so important for you, Jackie, to give us this historical context?
He led the most extraordinary life. I mean, as you say, he was born in
in Stalin's Russia. They were starving. They had absolutely nothing. And he had to overcome so much and to end up being the most sort of famous person in the world. I just think we had to show those early years just to really put him into context, just to really let an audience know how unique he was and how extraordinary he was.
You talk about the poverty, the fact that his father is away at war. And by the way, you have dancers. It's just exquisite. You have dancers sort of dancing out part of his story as the film goes along. But here's a little bit of Nureyev with Dick Cavett talking about how he still had to fight, even when his father came home from war, to be the dancer he knew he could be.
When my father came from the war, my mother conveyed to him my wish to be a dancer. And he was adamant against any kind of dancing.
How did you solve that?
I ran away each time at night and went to take some lessons in folklore groups and dance with them.
David, tell us more about that, the role of dance in Russian society, because right at the beginning of the film, you remind us that, you know, ballet for Russia was both its main cultural statement and its main political statement. And then both of those meet in Nureyev. Remind us why.
That was the one thing that they knew that could conquer the world. They had the greatest dancers. They had the greatest choreographers and teachers in the world. And so at the time of Nureyev's defection, they were going to the West, and it was just 2 months after Yuri Gagarin went into space.
Right.
And it was an enormous embarrassment to them. And 2 months after that, the Berlin Wall went up. So it's sort of, he was sort of sandwiched between two enormous events during the height of the Cold War.
Well, and it made world news. You know, his defection, you know, the ripples of it went all around the world.
Right. It was huge. I mean, just to have said that timeline again, Yuri Gagarin becomes the first man in space. Nureyev is considered, you know, also the great Russian man. The two of them were held up. Nureyev defects just a little bit later, and then the Berlin Wall goes up, as you say in the film, almost as a statement, like no one else gets out,
yeah, exactly.
You know, after him. Yeah. And he talks poignantly in later interviews about performing, and either it was Russian agents or, as he said, members of the Communist Party who came and were throwing things on the stage. I mean, this could have injured the greatest athlete slash artist in the world at that time. Let's listen.
They were throwing tear gas bombs and broken glass on stage, and it was incredible hullabaloo in Paris.
And how did you manage to concentrate while that was happening?
Tough it, you know?
Tough it out. Jackie, what happened to him? What happened to his friends, his teachers back at home after he defected?
Well, they were all punished. His two closest friends were scientists. It was a brother and sister. They were both scientists, and they were denied promotion for 10 years. Another close friend of his who was at university at the time, she was thrown out of the university. It had repercussions for everybody. But, you know, I went to Russia several times to interview his friends, because if he'd have lived, he would only have been in his 80s, early 80s now. Mm. So he still has a lot of friends who are alive. Mm. And none of them regretted any of it. You know, they talk about him as if it was yesterday. They are so loyal to him and so proud to have been part of his life and his escape.
Yeah.
And he was loyal to them all through, you know, he was smuggling money into them, to his parents, to his friends, and, you know, he never forgot them.
Well, he also was, meanwhile, turning the ballet world globally on its head. I mean, the way he danced, we see it in the film. Let's listen to someone describe it who saw it.
It was like seeing something from outer space. You know, men up until then had been sort of porteurs. They'd stood behind their ballerinas and supported them and occasionally danced solos and things. But there was the English style, which was extremely polite and refined. And this extraordinary animalistic person appeared.
As someone describing Nureyev dancing Swan Lake, And Jackie and David Morris, again, who have made this beautiful new documentary, Nureyev. As much as he discarded the rules in Soviet Russia, he discarded them around the world at a society party. He walks on a table, flicks a hairpiece off a woman. You know, it just, Richard Avedon, who photographed him stunningly, said that it was almost like an orgy of one. But you, as you look at him, David, you feel like, well, why wouldn't you kind of be that way? He was sort of extraterrestrial.
He was. And he was stunningly good looking, stunningly arrogant. You know, he was only in his early 20s, but as soon as he came to the West, he made a beeline for the most famous dancers in the world, Margot Fonteyn in England and Erik Brunn, who was a Danish star. And he got them both.
As you say at the very beginning of the film, great people are meteors designed to burn so that the earth may be lighted. But meteors, as we know, you know, have a
short life.
Yeah, and he did contract AIDS in the 1980s when there was no treatment. Died at 54, way too young.
Yeah,
and we're reminded of that in this, you know, incredibly poignant moment you have at the end of your film. He's coming. It's at Lincoln Center. He's just performed on stage. And he's stepping from that stage into Dick Cavett's studio set up there at Lincoln Center. And his entrance, I know we're just going to, you know, maybe we can post some of it at herenow.org, because you just have to see, just the way he enters, you know, is the best entrance into a TV interview I've ever seen. Let's just listen.
What have we got?
And you have to picture him walking out as if he's still in, like, the snakeskin outfit, and he's still the performer just walking onto, I mean, the applause goes on forever because what, Jackie, just his very being was remarkable.
Yeah, you know, he was the kind of person that would walk into a room and you wouldn't, you could have your back to him and you'd know that he'd walked into the room. It just sent ripples through everybody. And that, when we heard that interview, we thought that absolutely sums him up. You know, the whole world was behind him at one point. I mean, when he defected, he knew that he was never going to be able to see his mother again. And he didn't really until right at the end of her life. And we all followed that story. And I think that applause at the end was an applause for his life. You know, that was, you're an amazing person.
As Dick Cavett said, wow, more than Mick Jagger. Got more applause than Mick Jagger. Thank you for reminding us of that. Jackie and David Morris, the British brother and sister co-directors of the film Nureyev. It has its North American premiere this month. Look for it. Jackie, David, thank you so much.
That's a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, a revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave, control your comfort.
Stocks dropped this morning after the company 3M, that's the maker of Scotch tape and Post-it notes, announced it is planning to cut 2,000 jobs because of a drop in sales. It also said demand for its products weakened in China and other important markets. Joining us now with more on this is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Good day, sir.
So Scotch tape and Post-its are household products. We still use them. 3M makes about 60,000 other products as well. But what else does it make? Give us a little sense of what 3M does.
Yeah, it's a sprawling multinational. You'll recall the old name is Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing Company. Hmm. And it's seen a century of acquiring and building out brands. So there's also the Scotch-Brite scrubbing brush line. You have sanders that it makes, sealants, lubricants, air filters, hoses, mine and oil rig safety products. It's really an all-in-one industrial bellwether.
And why is it not doing so well right now?
It cited weak demand in the China automotive and electronics sectors and its inability to adapt to shifting needs and times. And I think that that kind of speaks to a problem right now we're seeing with conglomerates and multinationals writ large. You've seen it with, Kraft Heinz. This company is so sprawling, so acquisitive, and it's hard to shift gears across 95,000 employees. So you're seeing restructuring and likely divestitures down the pike. And it's the biggest hit for the stock since 1987.
And is this related to the trade war with China, or is this just about companies being nimble enough to adapt to the customer of today?
I really think it's the latter. You are seeing the trade war kind of as a catch-all excuse for companies and multinationals and quarterly earnings. But then there are others like P&G. They're doing very well. But we did have Caterpillar that just revealed weakening sales in its construction equipment business in China. So remains to be seen.
Okay, I want to ask you about another topic while we have you. Venmo, that's the digital money transfer app, reported significant growth in the first quarter. More than 40 million people used Venmo in the last 12 months, which is more users than most big banks. Pretty amazing.
Yeah, but it doesn't quite make money. The parent, PayPal, will theoretically make money on this hot but otherwise free Venmo service by upselling, debit cards, other advantages like instant transfer, pay with Venmo. It's still producing hundreds of millions of dollars of losses for PayPal, though, and I think it's a matter of wresting the bone from the dog's mouth. Millennials, they like free a bit too much.
Wouldn't they use Venmo, though, if there was a 5-cent fee on every single transaction? And think of how much money Venmo would make if that was the case.
And I'm not sure that could clear for them. Like, I take a payment in PayPal and it docked me for like a $25 t-shirt I sold a buck and a half. And so you would think twice about taking a PayPal payment. You would almost go back to checks or consider Apple Pay or something else.
Still, is Venmo's popularity changing the way that the big banks are thinking about their digital platforms?
Oh, yeah, they have to. The network effects of Venmo and the word of mouth of its popularity make it just ever harder to build market share. If you're a Wells or a JP Morgan Chase or a Citi, you're like, hey, what about me? What about me? But it's like 6 banking accounts or debit cards. How many online payment services can you expect people to sign up for? There is always that login fatigue.
You know, I'm just waiting for Facebook to start charging users $1 a year, which probably a lot of people would pay. And
yeah,
right there, you got $1 billion or whatever, however many users they have.
If you don't sell my info and sell your soul, then yes, I'll pay you $5 a month.
That's true. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Quick note now of a new study published in the journal Health Affairs that got our attention. It concluded that nearly 8 million middle-income elderly will not be able to afford housing or healthcare services needed to live a quality life in the coming decade. And by 2029, that number will almost double. This is the group that researchers call the forgotten middle. They won't be able to afford assisted living, but also don't qualify for subsidized housing and care. The goal of the National Investment Center for Senior Housing and Care, which sponsored the study, is to find incentives for building housing for middle-income seniors, as well as explore new pricing models in healthcare services for the elderly. So they definitely released a wake-up call. And there's been an ongoing one about plastics. The Pope has called for an end to plastic pollution of the oceans. National Geographic launched a campaign last year to wrap its magazine in paper instead of plastic. Have you replaced your plastic straws? Did you see that video of one stuck in the nose of a sea turtle? It will make you run out to find paper or metal. Few people are unaware of the way plastics are smothering our environment, clogging the oceans, killing wildlife. What can we do as individuals? Well, 17-year-old Isabel Thorpe and 18-year-old Kate Shortman had the same question, but they are about to have a very big stage. They are 2 of 9 British athletes who've received Olympic Solidarity Grants. This is money, a few hundred a month, from the International Olympic Committee to help in their attempt to qualify for the 2020 Games. That's their main goal. But last month, they also performed their synchronized world championship routine in a pool filled with plastic, bottles, bags, toiletries. Oh, look, there's a piece of bubble wrap wrapped around a perfectly pointed toe. They both join us from the UK on Skype. Kate, Isabel, are you there?
Hiya.
Well, you synchronize your hellos as well. This is mesmerizing. I just, first of all, we're going to have this video that was put together by the Big Bang Fair. We'll talk about that in a second. We'll have that at hereandnow.org. People really have to see this, to see how clogged this pool was. And Kate, if you could start by just talking about some of the moves you were trying to make and what was happening.
Yeah, so it was really hard to swim in the actual plastic. Like, it really simulated what it would be like for the animals. So every time we went to do a thrust or a boost, there would be a bag in the way that was stopping your hand sculling or your leg from egg beating, which like propulses you upwards. So obviously for the animals, that would be really hard to like swim through, especially for like propulsing around the pool or come out of the pool.
Isabel, Kate just mentioned some things, thrust. That's when you thrust yourself up out of the water.
Yeah.
We see moves like, you know, you lay out in sort of a back bend.
Yeah, so for a lot of the routine, you can't see where you're going because you're not facing the direction you're going to swim in, or you're upside down. You can't see anything. It's very disorienting. So there's a lot of plastic in the way that you don't really know is there. Like Kate said, you just get caught in the bags or stuff underwater, and you just can't avoid it, really.
It's quite something. And let's face it, synchronized swimming has been mocked famously on Saturday Night Live. But it is the hardest thing you can do in the water. You've talked to famous speed swimmers who try it. They don't have the breath for it.
No, it's so much harder than it looks, because we both do speed swimming alongside synchro, and we've done gymnastics as well. And it's sort of a combination of gymnastics, dance, speed swimming. You have to have the agility of a gymnast. And so it's a lot harder than it looks. And people think we push off the bottom and stuff and push off the floor. We can't do that. We will get points deducted or disqualified. It's so much harder than it looks. It's so good for it to be
publicized
to get synchro's name out there as a minority sport, and also to raise awareness for plastic pollution is a really good thing.
Well, there's a moment when you're coming up, it is part of that thrust. And as you said, you're not pushing off the ground. And so that when we see synchronized swimmers pop up quickly from under the water, it's from your own propulsion. But doing that with bubble wrap and a milk bottle around your leg, it seems impossible.
Yeah, it's like already it is really hard. Plastic and everything, it just makes it like five times harder.
It adds a lot of like resistance and like weight. So
there's another slow moment. This is when you two both come up slowly through the water. And this is a point where you've probably been underwater for over a minute and you're dying, but you look so serene.
Yeah, with regards to the sport, it's such a mentally challenging sport as well, because you're 24/7 getting corrections. There's a very subjective element to the sport. It's not just about hitting a time like with speed swimming. So for you to come out of the water after doing like a really long figure and not being able to breathe, like gasping for air, you still have to look elegant and execute it really well. Otherwise, you're not going to get the recognition from the judges. So with regards to like the animals, obviously they don't have to look graceful like we do, but it would just be really hard for them with the plastic. The air they breathe in would be like restricted. So
Well, we know this performance was requested by the Big Bang Fair. That's an annual science fair for young up-and-coming scientists and engineers. When you first heard about this, when somebody asked you to do this, was this something plastic that you'd already been thinking about?
It was definitely an eye-opener for both of us, because I think that obviously we know about the issues of pollution and plastic pollution, everything.
It's really brought about like a lot of publicity for it as well. Like Katy Perry, I think she retweeted our video, which was like amazing.
Well, the World Economic Forum put statistics over you guys attempting to swim in this muck. A garbage truck of plastic is dumped into the ocean every minute, adding to the tons already there. When scientists tested crustaceans in the Mariana Trench, deepest part of the ocean, 100% of them had plastic in their lungs. I mean, a quarter of the plastic in the ocean is single use. So this is part of the campaign to go to a circular economy, reuse plastics. Well, it's quite something. Again, we'll have the video at herenow.org. But meanwhile, here you are trying to get to the 2020 Olympics. You finished eighth at the European Championships. You just also finished fifth at the Artistic Swimming World Series in Paris. That was in March. So moving your way up. You talked about synchronized swimming being a minority sport.
Yeah, no, definitely. A lot of people do see it as an art instead of a sport. And I think that this pollution advertisement really helped with the like getting synchro's name out there as well as raising awareness for pollution, which was really good, especially in the UK where it is a lot smaller than in other countries like Russia, America, like it's a lot bigger.
Isabel, what we can see in the video, and it helps you at one point, is that your routine is based on karate and you are sort of chopping your way through some of this plastic. Let's talk about your routine. And this reminder, synchronized swimming has been in the Olympics since 1984. There's music above and below the water. There are free and technical routines. Points are given, 50% for technical ability, 50% for artistic. The swim world has been buzzing about your routine since the fall. It is karate themed. We'll post it at hereandnow.org along with the plastics video. But let's listen to a little. You walk out at the 2019 French Open in Montreal onto the pool deck, suddenly do a karate move, a few others, and then you're into the pool. And then the two of you are like egg beaters churning through this water.
Yeah, so our new routine is karate themed and it's kind of directed towards the fact that we're going to Tokyo for the Olympics. And we've had a martial arts specialist come in and help us with some of the moves. As you can probably see in the video, I like us doing like lots of karate movements. And we tried to get the martial arts specialist to really help us get the feel for it.
But no plastics at the Olympics. I want to go back to your plastics video. And Kate, do you anticipate doing something like this again? I mean, I could just see you going on a tour and swimming in pools filled with plastic.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. It's a really good cause. And it's like while simultaneously getting synchronized swimming on the map. So yeah, definitely.
That's Kate Shortman and Isabel Thorpe. They made quite a splash, sorry about that, when they did their world championship routine in a pool filled with floating plastic waste. We'll have the edited video that's flying around at hereandnow.org. Ladies, thank you so much, and also best of luck to you in your quest for 2020.
Thank you.
Again, we'll have both the plastics video and their real routine at hereandnow.org. I'm going to give you a second now to close your eyes and imagine their karate and martial arts inspired Olympic routine. It's hard.
According to the AARP, 10,000 baby boomers turn 65 every day. And as Americans age, many will need help, some in nursing homes. That could be a human or a robot, which are being used more and more for elder care. Joining us now is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
So a lot of people think robots and the elderly are a perfect match. Why?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of questions about this and whether it will work. I think the idea here is that eventually this will be a really big industry. Right now, it is tiny. Japan, for instance, is putting in $30, $50 million at a time through organizations like its labor department. There's a reporting from Reuters that says the government has put certain kinds of robots in 5,000 facilities around the country. But there have been estimates that in Japan alone, the industry will be approaching $4 billion in about 15 years, and that is in part because the country is anticipating a 380,000 specialized worker shortfall in the next 6 years. Right. And you kind of scale that to a global level, and you're looking at tens of billions of dollars at the very least, and these huge worker shortfalls in taking care of the elderly. The United Nations says that by 2050, there will be twice as many people over 60 that there are today, and it's really unlikely that the rest of the population is going to be able to do all of this care work for the elderly.
Well, and in Japan, it's a perfect example of a place that has an aging population. And so they're going to be dealing with this maybe in a bigger way than other countries right away. So tell us what these robots do.
Yeah. So you have a lot of different startups building this hardware and software right now. You have a robot, LEQ, for example, that is a kind of conversational robot that helps answer and deliver messages. For instance, $1,500. The first 12 months of service is free for that robot. So there's definitely a software service component here. There's a subscription service model in that. And really, it's just there to kind of converse with a person and talk talk to them and help them deliver messages and accept messages. You also have a Belgium-based company called Zora Bots. Their legged robot, Zora, is a bit more pricey. It's $18,000. It's about the size of a toddler. It can walk. The company has sold 1,000 of these robots around the world. And again, there's kind of a conversational aspect here, providing companionship as well as making sure that the person the robot is, quote unquote, caring for is in good health and able to do the things that they need to do throughout their day.
And could you also say to the robot, go get me that book over there or something like that, and it will do that?
So we're not really there yet, right? Okay. Some of these robots are getting pretty good at being conversational, but they're not necessarily great at like going and picking things up and bringing them back to you. We have robots that do these sorts of things, but a lot of the companies that are in this space right now don't have robots that do these things.
Well, and I also wonder if they're going to be better than Alexa and Siri. Whenever I ask them a question, the answer is usually, I don't know. Let me Google that.
Right. And you have to, of course, think that Amazon is really at the forefront of this conversational ability with its devices. So you look at smaller companies that have less power, software power behind them. They're not as good as Alexa, and Alexa is still not that great. So,
and we're still talking about a very expensive robot. You said $18,000 for one of them.
Yeah, so Zora Bots, the company from Belgium, they have an $18,000 robot. Some of the others I mentioned, again, $1,500. There's one that's $5,000. It's a Japanese robot called Paro, and it's a fuzzy seal-shaped robot that's supposed to be really used for therapy in hospitals and care-giving facilities.
What do the robots still lack that an actual person could do?
I mean, so much, like everything from fine motor skills at a very basic level of like pouring water into a glass for you to, I think, also really having that human connection, right? So Zora, as we've been talking about, that robot has been involved in some studies that have shown that in Australia, for instance, there were people in an elder care facility that were developing sort of emotional attachments to this robot. So you do start to see the beginnings of kind of like personal interactions with these robots that really become valuable for people who are older and are feeling that kind of loneliness that can happen. But again, these are very, 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 very basic robots that can't really hold a conversation with you in the same way a human nurse or caregiver would.
So overall, a good idea to use robots to help care for the elderly?
This is such a tough question, right? On the one hand, it feels inevitable that we're going to need help in caring for our aging populations. So getting started now on designing robots to do that and trying to build them ethically and carefully, I think is really important. On the other hand, meeting societal challenges like aging populations and kind of being honest with ourselves about what we do with the elderly. I mean, do we want to answer all of these questions with hardware and software? Is that a cure-all? I think there are really big questions about class here too, right? The dystopian version of this is really dark. You've got broken down robots that you can imagine haven't had their software supported and are hackable, taking care of your grandmother, while the robot company's CEO's grandmother can probably afford to have like real human nurses. Mm-hmm. So I think there are complicated issues like data privacy and regulation involved here, but also I think we should be thinking a lot about what these machines should really be doing before we charge them up and let them loose on the old folks' home.
That's Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for us at Here and Now. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.